Hello and welcome to the This Week in South Florida podcast. I'm Glenna Milberg. We have a great show for you today. It's all about the Bahamas and the relief and the aid and the insane and unprecedented wave of humanitarian assistance coming from South Florida. And with us today, we have City of Miami Fire Chief Joe Zuralban. We have Global Empowerment Missions founder Michael Capone, and from Blue Tide Marine, Bob Pudney, who all have been on the front lines of doing exactly that. Chief, let's start with you. You and your men and women, along with your county counterparts, were among the first as the first responders, really, to get on the ground right after Hurricane Dorian decimated a few islands. What did you find and what did you do?
Well, we began by embedding our firefighters with five Coast Guard cutters. And we knew that the Coast Guard was going to be among the first people on the ground as well. So we wanted to get actionable intelligence. And they were the first wave that went out. After that, we sent a team of 15 combined with a team of 15 from Miami-Dade County Fire
and
Rescue.
And this was mostly a medical mission, wasn't it?
Yes, these were firefighter paramedics, although everyone we sent was trained and experienced in urban search and rescue. So if that needed to happen, they were able and willing and equipped to perform that mission. But really what you need to do as soon as a storm comes through is you need to get on the ground as quickly as possible, and you need to touch every single resident, and you need to search every single home. So when we arrived in the Grand Bahamas, that was our mission. They could not get to the east end of the island at all. So our mission was to gain access and get all the way to the end, to the water, and then work our way back and touch every single resident and every single home on the island.
And that's, you know, you say that so easily, but that's kind of a daunting task.
Absolutely.
You know, you mentioned the people on the East End, you know, in the days, and we have hindsight now a little bit, in the days after Dorian went through and just kind of sat over the Bahamas for a while. There was just it underwater, I mean, it was immobile. And Michael Capone and Bob Pudney, you were on the front lines of really right away collecting money. I think right the day after we were together, you were in a warehouse starting the logistics. And as of our conversation today, you've been responsible for 200,000 pounds of relief. What does that look like? How did you even do that?
No, there's another 150,000 that's about to go out too now.
So yeah, this isn't the end. Yeah, this is the beginning.
The very beginning.
Yeah.
Yay, by God. It all just, everybody comes together.
Like but I that said, was, I mean, there were some serious logistics there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, of course, of course. And
that Talk takes, about that a little
know,
bit.
It takes a lot of training. I mean, we teamed up with, you know, this great, great group of people. You know, Bob, we couldn't have done it without these guys. I mean, they're Navy SEAL trained, experts. They were actually the ones, you know, also on the ground. Miami Fire was Freeport, right?
East of Freeport, East End, yes.
Yeah, the East End of Freeport, and these teams were in, you know, probably about 10, 12 different islands landing and stuff. Why don't you?
You know, you listen to Michael talk, and Michael's always sort of very generous with making sure everybody knows this is a team effort. Bob, with Blue Marine, you and for some former Navy SEALs got in there. I guess that's some serious expertise on how to get into a really tough place where people are hurting. Talk about that a little bit.
You know, our mission was essentially the same as Chief outlined for the Miami-Dade Fire Department. We, as special operations guys, our whole career is being small, fast, adaptable. And we've seen, you know, year after year on this disaster response front where it doesn't matter where it occurs, there's always a 96-hour gap before awareness is built and relief agencies know where to go.
Yeah.
And so our goal was, we didn't have the manpower to do interact with every person on the ground, but we wanted to find communities that had a good headcount and that they knew specifically what they needed and what they didn't need. And our goal was to raise that awareness, both with the Bahamian government, as well as the nonprofits and all those relief organizations, so that, you know, it was a more expedient and efficient way to get rescuers and aid to people. So our team consisted of former military special operations guys, and then we had tremendous critical care doctors and paramedics with every team. So it was a medical and an awareness mission. We started off with a seaplane provided by Tropic Ocean Airways, who none of the things that we accomplished would have been possible without the mobility of the seaplane. So while
right, the Bahamas, I mean, air and sea, that's how you get there.
That's right. So, you know, on the first day we flew over the Abacos, Marsh Harbor Airport was underwater. We anticipated putting both teams in by seaplane. We put one team in at Great Iguana Cay, and we set up a Zodiac operation that would go from island to island and just build awareness and provide medical attention if needed. And then we intended to land at Treasure Key by water, and then we noticed the runway was open. So we were able to land on the runway and then put a ground team. The next day, we were able to bring in dirt bikes and ATVs. Mobility is always the biggest challenge for that first group of responders. All the roads were blocked with, you know, downed trees. Most vehicles on the island didn't work. So we learned a lot about how to, you know, make the best use of that mobility. And I think that we were able to inform kind of how the follow-on responders and relief organizations could maximize their effort.
This sounds like a true military operation right there. Chief, you work for government.
Yes.
Here. What was the coordination with the Bahamian government in those early days with what you were doing? Because really, the Bahamian government, much of it was sort of, they were hit too. They were victimized as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you see that in every disaster we respond to, whether it's within the United States, its territories, or outside of the U.S., the government is typically shocked in the first 48 hours, and it takes a little while to mobilize or to recover from that level of devastation. So really, our primary mission is to get in there, help the government understand what they're dealing with, and then help them to develop some priorities. And those priorities essentially are the same wherever you go. The first priority is life safety. You have to touch everybody on the in the impacted area to determine if they have an immediate need.
Give us an idea when you were doing that. I mean, that had to be just a gut-wrenching in some cases. Do you have any instances or stories that really stuck with you about that?
Absolutely. One in particular was an American couple. They actually live, their primary home is in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and they have a vacation home in the Bahamas. And they were the only ones who stayed behind in their community. And they have a harrowing story where the second story of their house was just sheared right off. And they were very quickly pushed out of the first story by storm surge. And they ended up putting goggles on, mask, fin, and snorkels, and made their way over to another house that was intact.
Oh my gosh.
They grabbed onto a power line. Thankfully, the power was out by then. They grabbed onto a down power line and pulled themselves to the house, tried to get in the door. The door was locked. A strong gust of wind came and blew the door right open and gave them refuge.
Oh my gosh.
So they were, when we came upon them, they were completely in shock. And many people that you see immediately after a storm have that same look, that same gaze. And essentially they are in shock. So it's important to get to them as quickly as possible and determine if there are any life-threatening needs, but it's also important to come back and check on them. Yeah. So we came back on day two and touched everybody again. And what we realized was these people were essentially circling the drain in what they were doing. They could not understand the priorities for themselves. They were picking up toiletry items, putting them in bags, and they were losing sight of the big picture. The big picture was, you survived one of the greatest disasters we have ever seen, and now it's time to go home and collect yourselves and figure out how you want to rebuild your life, not be the only people in the community that are sleeping there through the night with no protection and no long-term plan and very few supplies.
Yeah.
So we ended up explaining to them what their situation was, calling their family on the phone, trying to get their family to convince them to leave, and ultimately boarding up their house for them so they felt secure enough where they could leave. And then finally we convinced them to come out with us, and we were able to take them out and get them out of the country.
That is an incredible story about this couple, and I think it really shows, Michael, you probably see this all the time, people who are victimized suddenly by disaster, natural disaster, there's no precedent for that in someone's life. Right? I mean, what do you see when you're delivering all of what you have? You've got the basics, soap, you've got toothpaste, you've got toilet paper, but then there are building supplies that you need to bring in, and tools and tents. I mean, there's from immediate needs to long-term needs, and you see a lot of that.
First thing we do is we go in there and we listen to the locals and we listen to their stories and we listen to what they need. The first thing I say is, what do you guys need? And usually it's,
and what do they tell you? What do you
hear?
Well,
at first it's the short-term aid. I mean, a lot of people wanted to just evacuate that, you know, people that lived in places like Marsh, it's just get me out of here. There's nothing left.
Yeah, which is different than this story.
And then, some islands were slightly damaged, 50% damaged or anything. And listen, I heard after 5 days, man, get us building supplies. We need plywood to fix our roof. We need boats, we need tarps.
So the people stayed.
What?
The people who
There's
stayed.
There's a lot of people that stayed, and they're waiting, and we have a warehouse filling up right now with construction materials, and, you know, this is this thing. We're going out now with, you know, 25 containers at a time on big barges, and we're going to start giving each island, you know, massive amounts of, you know, construction materials, because you got to get them back moving. Otherwise, the whole economy is going to be so stagnant, the whole entire thing is going to crumble.
Yeah, so when you, and we heard from Governor Ron DeSantis actually talked about this when he was in Dania Beach. He, you know, the state of Florida delivered, his estimate was $11 million worth of aid for the long term. And he talked about transitional housing and having, you know, giving people a place to stay while they're there, rebuilding their own communities. Bob, when they, as this process starts, mm-hmm. are there enough people there who have a stabilized life after the storm, who are that workforce?
Sure, I think there is. I think in Marsh Harbor, the epicenter of the damage, maybe not so much because they've fled that area. Treasure Key is still, a lot of people got out of there as well. But if you go north on Abaco and you get to Little Abaco Island, that road was blocked by trees. Once it was cleared, we found out that the bridge was out. So there was a whole population of 5 or 6 cities that spanned from Cooperstown to Foxtown that had no way of relief getting to them. Very shallow in the Bahamas, so this idea of a big ship pulling up with supplies wasn't going to happen.
Right.
So, you know, with we get all this information from the locals. They tell us, hey, the bridge is out, we need help up there right now. And so we put in some boats and we get there and we see this community that used to be maybe 90 people and now it's 20 people. But those 20 people are the pastor, you know, they're the leaders of this community, and they see it as a responsibility to rebuild their community and bring their, you know, families back in. So, you know, it's not for us to tell them they have to leave. They were safe, but they had no supplies. So we set up a little supply chain. And one of the things we did in that instance, just because we had small little inflatable boats, we couldn't get a lot of supplies to them, quickly realized that they were going to need some more every day. So, you know, using our military experience, we rigged parachutes made out of tarps, and we were able to drop 42 bundles. Each one was about 40 pounds, and the parachute is a tarp. So they were able to collect that, immediately put it to use for shelter, and that was going to sustain them for probably 4 or 5 more days.
What a great idea.
Well, it's we've actually been doing it in the yachting industry to, as a maritime logistics piece, not, you know, so rudimentary that using tarps. But it was good to take some skills we had from the military that we've been trying to privatize into the commercial business and then be able to use that for effect. You know, it's hard, always hard when you transition from the military to the private sector. This, for my entire company, this was, it closed a hole where we could go back to our roots and help people right away.
That's amazing. Is there, Chief, you know, you at Urban Search and Rescue that so many people in the department are part of, and, you know, to be clear, that's, they were not there as that, as
yes.
that team, but as the firefighter paramedics. You've done that before. You've done what you did in the Bahamas before.
Yes.
Has this instance taught you anything different? Has something happened where you took a sudden lesson with you for the next time?
I think in this case, it was, I won't say learned a lesson, I'll say it reinforced a lesson. And one of the things that we have learned throughout our many disasters, everything from the World Trade Center to the Haiti earthquake, to Hurricane Katrina, and all of the hurricanes in between, is that you have to have, and it was discussed relative to the difficulty in getting around the island, you have to have a plan going in, and you have to be able to logistically support your own plan, because we have a saying within our organization, if you don't bring it, you won't have it.
Yeah.
So for us going into this particular situation, what we learned in Hurricane Katrina was bring everything you believe you're going to need with you so that you can do things that others can't, because that's essentially why you're here. The reason you're coming to help is so you can perform, you can fill in gaps, you can do what the government has no ability to do.
What are those things that you bring?
One example for mobility, and it's a great example, is the ability to go drive these high water vehicles that we have through marshland, through difficult terrain.
Bob was mentioning you brought some of that too.
And access areas that that they otherwise couldn't access. So we were actually the first people by land to be able to get to the east end of the island.
And you brought those things aboard the ferry when you got there?
Absolutely. We brought them aboard the Beleria. They have a large cargo area underneath, and our vehicles are 10 feet tall, and they were able to accommodate them and get them in for us so that we could be effective when we hit the ground.
What about on the private sector side, Michael Capone? You've been doing sort of, you've perfected the professional private sector response. And I know that really blossomed for you after the Haiti earthquake. That became sort of the global empowerment.
Things training,
mission.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was there anything that you found this time, or are finding, because you're still doing it, that was a lesson that you hadn't really understood before?
So every disaster I've ever been to, I would always say, if I only had been here 2-3 days earlier, it would have been completely different. This time I was actually in the Amazon with 200 firefighters that we put on the ground there that are still working.
Amazon disaster.
And I saw this thing coming, and I immediately flew back 2 days before it hit. I contacted Rob because I meditated on it, and I was like, without seaplanes, you're not going to go anywhere in these outer islands.
Rob at Tropic Air.
We had a meeting. The Bahamian government, gets a lot of heat, but I do want to make it known that, before the storm even hit, we were at the General Counsel's house on the phone with the Prime Minister and the Ambassador, planning all these things, getting authorizations, everything. These guys were in the meetings already. They were on the phone telling them, we're going to need to get this equipment in. We're going to need... So all this stuff was in preparation, and that allowed these guys to bring in their stuff. That's why the storm passed over Freeport. As soon as there wasn't, 100 mile an hour winds, the planes landed with everything.
So these guys were
the first in Freeport. We were the first in the Abacos.
Wait, somebody like you and your group have access to government. How does that happen? Did they reach out to you? Did you reach out to them? How does that happen?
In this particular case, it happened because of our partner Rob from Flytropic.
So you had connections.
Because he's an airline that deals with the Bahamian government and all that, right? So I come from a nightlife background, right? So you have to figure out how to get in the where or whatever. It's really kind of the same thing. Every disaster, right? I was just in South America, right? And we were immediately working with, the governor of the state of Amazon. How did that happen? It's the same thing. You got to infiltrate immediately. You got to make your relationships. You got to set up a plan.
So I think what you just said was your experience as a nightlife promoter makes you great at disaster humanitarian relief.
Really,
is that the technique?
People laugh, and it's amazing the amount of...
It's a skill.
Of learning things from. I'm very grateful for it.
How about you, Rob? Were you a big party guy?
I grew up in South Florida, and I think I may have used Michael's name a few times trying to get into a nightclub. Now I'm working with him to help people, so that's good. On the Bahamian government coordination side, for us as a private company, I can understand why there would be skepticism. So much good, well-intended helpers want to come to an emergency. But if they're creating a rescue problem for the rescuers, that's always a problem. So one of the things we tried to really message before the storm to a private businessman here in Miami, his name's Andy Ingram, and he has great deep connections with the Bahamian government and the General Counsel, or Counsel General Linda Mackey, was, we're not going to be calling you for rescue. These are all the capabilities we're bringing, just like the chief said. We are not going to add to your problem. We're going to help your problem. And I hope that we now have built that trust. But that was certainly a risk they had to take to allow us in when they did. And I'm grateful for that, because I think we were able to help people. But certainly that's always a problem. And like the chief mentioned, I saw tons of well-intended people coming by plane or boat. And then they got there and they had no means to move around. And if they had a problem, they were just going to, a medical problem or something like that, they were just going to further burden the rescue effort. So, the government had a large task to manage all that. And I would say that any government, whether it's the United States or elsewhere, has that same problem immediately in the first few days after a storm.
Yeah, Linda Mackey, the Consul General, was actually with us on This Week in South Florida, our broadcast last week. Of course, she was right in the thick of it then. This is an ongoing effort, and I am grateful that both public and private sector humanitarian rock stars are with us today for this podcast. Michael Capone with the Global Empowerment Mission, Chief Joe Zerabon with the City of Miami Fire Department, Bob Putney with Blue Tide Marine, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast today. And thank you for joining us. I'm Glenna Milberg. We'll see you next week. We'll listen to you next week, I guess. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.